Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daoust. Thursdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and the cultures of consciousness await. Today, Philip K. Dick's exegesis. Over 20 years ago, I remember the first guy who slipped me a Philip K. Dick novel, A Very Strange Fellow, appropriately in Berkeley, California. And like I think probably more than a few listeners to the show, I became rather addicted to Phil Dick's work and wrote my senior thesis on his craziness, his delightful, inspiring absurdity. And little did I know that 20 years later, or a little bit more, I would be recruited to be part of the editorial team wrestling the monster that is Philip K. Dick's exegesis into some publishable form, which I'm very happy to say has been published. The big, fat, 1,000-page abridgment of the exegesis is out. And we're going to be talking with one of the co-editors today, Pam Jackson. And it should be a great time, but I thought I would just say a little bit about what the editorial process was like, because it was pretty monstrous. As some listeners know, Phil Dick had a very strange experience in the early months, or beginning in the early months of 1974, living in Orange County, and having what could be called a set of mystical experiences or psychotic breakdowns or paranormal incursions or downloads from the cosmic mind. You know, he never could figure it out, and neither will you. And this event inspired, you know, a great deal of his subsequent published fiction and writings, but it also inspired this enormous private document, mostly handwritten, that we call the exegesis, in which he relentlessly attacked his experience from every possible imaginable angle, you know, wrestling with it through the wee hours of the night, and leaving behind him, when he died in 1982, an enormous pile of paper that was organized in a number of folders. And so part of our task was to turn these handwritten pages, or really Xeroxes of these handwritten pages, into material that could be edited and turned into a printed volume. So I was one of the team of folks who read through the original folders and selected portions to transcribe, and then later on Pamela edited those into some manageable format, and it was you know, incredible labor of love and mania, sort of appropriate for the loving mania of the text themselves. And probably the most fun part of the whole experience was getting to go and actually get my hands on the exegesis itself, because we wanted to scan some of the many doodles that he included in his document, these diagrams of metaphysical possibilities, structures of time, elaborate charts of his own earlier works, which were seen to hold secret messages that explained his current experiences. And so we got to go to a law office and sit there with the materials themselves and go through them and pick out images, and the you know, the resulting volume, which is in some ways this monster behemoth of a text, is very much illuminated and enlightened by these many diagrams and drawings. So that was a real gas, and working on the whole thing was a very satisfying. So I'm very happy to have Pam on the show today. But first, we'll bring on our co-host, of course, Maja Dau, White Witch of Los Angeles. How are you doing today?
I'm good, Eric. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm about to leave to Texas and go home to San Francisco for a week and have a little Thanksgiving with the folks.
Nice.
So I'm a happy camper. Have you seen the published exegesis?
I haven't seen it yet, but I'm excited. I first came across Philip K. Dick when I was a teenager. I would go through like the science fiction section in the public library, and I saw the title, "Flow My Tears," the policeman said, and I was like, "What is this?" You know, I was like, that title was just so nuts. And then I read that, and that was it. From then on, I was just like, oh, my God, who is this guy? And then I read, like, everything. So to get a hold of these, you know, secret criticisms of his brain is pretty exciting, I think.
Yeah, yeah, it's a pretty impressive volume, too, when you actually hold it in your hand. You're like, especially when you consider that it's roughly one-tenth of the actual.
So nuts.
Jesus, yeah, you'd need 9 more 1,000-page volumes at least to include the rest of it, but I think we did a pretty good job of including the best stuff.
Wow.
The best stuff. So so let's bring on Pam. Pam, how are you doing?
Good.
Hi. And you're calling from, are you in Berkeley?
I'm in Berkeley, yep.
Appropriate, excellent. And you were recently at a Phil Dick panel down in Los Angeles?
Yeah, we had a panel at the Central Library down there on Monday night. It was really fun.
Who was on it?
Well, me and Jonathan, my co-editor Jonathan Lethem, and Laura Leslie, Philip K. Dick's eldest daughter. And then we had a surprise. Joining us at the last minute was Steve Erickson, the novelist who is one of the annotators of the volume. And he showed up and took the place of Issa, Philip K. Dick's other daughter, who wasn't able to attend.
Well, that sounds like a great time. Was there some interesting folks in the audience?
Yeah, yeah, we got some good questions. And people were really excited to have the book. I felt for the first time like, wow, we we succeeded.
Yeah, yeah. Well, your story was
so focused on everything that didn't go as planned. And
yeah, that's always the way. I mean, it's publishing's kind of cruel that way. You know, at some point, you know, people talk about when you know something's done, and sometimes it's just when you know you can manage to just extricate yourself from it with, you know, flaws and all. I think overall, it's still a great, great accomplishment. And you know, I mean, you're it's funny. You're like, you know this. You know, if you're interested in Philip K. Dick, if you're interested in his ideas and the world that he lived and the way he saw it, his experiences, I mean, it's sort of a holy grail. It's been that way for Philip K. Dick fans for, you know, quite a long time. And there were some earlier portions of it that were published, but, you know, clearly there's a whole group of folks who are going to be extremely happy with it. But you're in this funny position where you know this text better by far than anyone. And I really just wanted, you know, kind of to get the story on there. I mean, when did you first get interested in the exegesis specifically, you know, as you were, you know, working and reading Phil Dick?
Well, I didn't encounter it for a while. I started by reading through all of his novels, but then when I read Valis and found out that there actually was an exegesis, I became obsessed with the idea of the exegesis. And I also heard about the fact that it was not accessible, people hadn't read it, it was this holy grail to so many people. And so I was both fascinated that there was this mystery around it for fans. And also, I also really wanted to see what was in it. I had never heard of a book like Valis where somebody sort of made his own spiritual process part of a story like this. And the exegesis is actually a main character of that novel. So that was what started me on that road.
And then you wrote your dissertation on the exegesis, even though you really couldn't get your hands on very much of that.
Right.
So how did you kind of frame it at that point?
Well, at that point I was using the volume that Lawrence Sutton put together, which is just fragments, really. I mean, ours is fragments too, but It's about a third of the size of ours. And I was trying to use that to talk about what had happened in 2374, as he named the experience, what had happened and how it started off this journey of seeking that became the exegesis, as well as his last three novels, Valis and Divine Invasion and Transmigration of Timothy Archer. So I pored through what was there of the exegesis, and then also everything in the letters that had been published, to try to figure out what he thought he had experienced, and then try to put it in the context of the rest of his fiction, his life's work, and what was to come.
Yeah, well, I'm curious, how did your feelings change about it once you got your hands on the whole monster and spent, years with it? Did your, sort of original sense of what might have happened or how he was thinking about it change drastically? Or how, in a way you're sort of sitting with the same enigma that he was sitting with for his, the rest of his life, last 10 years of his life or 8 years of his life. How did that change for you as you became familiar with the material?
Well, it changed a lot. For one thing, when I framed my thesis around this moment where, as he said, he had fallen into his own fiction. His fiction had been writing, had presented situations over and over again where reality is just radically broken apart, the masks are stripped away, and underneath the mask is something else. And that's exactly what happened to him. And one of the interesting things about that was that it caused him to go back and go through his own fiction to try to see whether it held any clues to what exactly this was about. So he went, he became a student of himself, and that's what a lot of the exegesis is about. It's analysis of Ubik and Flow My Tears, the Policeman Said, and all the others, in the light of what the revelation that happened to him.
Well,
but in my dissertation, I didn't, in a way, I just didn't realized that it wasn't just a funny, like, Philip K. Dick trauma. It was also a vast spiritual experience, and it opened up into all of these intense philosophical and religious explorations that I had to take more seriously once I saw the thing itself.
Well, this is something that's always been really interesting to me about the whole PKD phenomenon, is he had, like, a singular experience, right? And then kind of the rest of his life is about trying to, like you say, philosophically criticize and get to the bottom of it. But do you feel like he prevented himself maybe from having more of those experiences, or did going through your work, did it seem like he was in that constant state from then on, or was it more like retrospecting that singular experience?
Well, it was actually this was something I didn't know until I read the thing. The revelations continued. There wasn't just that one moment, but the revelations were intermixed with this exploration of them in writing, in language, that he started at that time. So there's this unfolding of the revelation and the exegesis of the revelation at one time, and he changes. Depending on his mood, sometimes he'll say the exegesis is getting in the way of the revelation, and other times he's saying that that it's getting to it. It's getting him to it.
And sometimes it even seems like it is it. It's really, really interesting. I mean, one thing that was fun to do reading through the material was to try to almost get a something that we had intended to do, but we didn't get around to for this particular edition, but is really to go through and almost isolate all the different events and the different kinds of experiences that he was sort of reading as being revelatory. And one thing that became really clear to me, I don't know if you have the same sense, Pam, but a lot of the things were definitely hypnagogic. They were happening in the, you know, between waking and sleeping state. And at many, oftentimes in this state, he would hear a voice, and then he would write down, you know, AI voice or voice or in a little colon, and then he'd have these, like, short, rather cryptic phrases. So it was almost like he was kind of like, you know, keep trying to keep all the lines open. You know, like he was waiting for these messages, you know, to arrive, but almost because of the way that they would then inspire further writing, you know, further explanation. Like he would immediately kind of weave it into the stories that he was already talking about what might have happened. And it's almost like a feedback loop. I mean, very unusual. I can't think of anything that's really analogous to this, even though there's a lot of interesting texts that people who have had very weird experiences have made, and, you know, strange models of the universe and conspiracy theories and all these kinds of things. It's similar to a lot of material that I've seen, but nothing like this in terms of its sort of literary self-consciousness. It's a very magical document in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's the voice, when it comes out, it sometimes both seems to respond to what he's been thinking about and to sort of set it off in a new direction. And often it comes in at a key moment when he's sort of exhausted himself and he's kind of grinding away and not getting anywhere. And suddenly there's this message from the voice, or sometimes it's from somewhere else, that will start him up again. And so there is this feedback loop, like you say, of these messages and then the exegesis.
Well, you know, in the 70s and 80s, when critics first started writing about him a lot for science fiction studies, and where a sort of kind of cult following developed, and then developed into the Philip K. Dick Society, and people were doing this. There were a lot of people who just didn't even want to think about this side of his fate. You know, he was a novelist. He was dealing with, you know, modern reality. He was dealing with politics, with economics. And yes, he was always had a little wacky spiritual side. But a lot of people were like, you know, including, you know, probably people in his family were like, let's just leave that aside. It's a little much. And that seems to be kind of changing. And how do you kind of see that now, in terms of the way that people think about him, in terms of being somebody who went through a very unusual kind of revelation experience, rather than just someone who was like a really great writer who was kind of nutty, and this is the nutty part?
It does seem like it's part of an overall shift, both in culture and in academic studies, of a greater interest in revelation and spiritual experience. You probably have more to say about that than I would.
Yeah, that's one of the things that makes him interesting. It's almost more for me on the other side. Like, I think he's a great writer, and I've learned a huge amount from his books, and I think there's a reason that they've been canonized, over the last couple decades, not just because, you know, a lot of his stories and novels have been made into film, but because, you know, his writing speaks to, you know, concerns beyond science fiction in a way that few writers of his generation really do. I know that Steve Erickson, this, you know, very interesting, very accomplished novelist, you know, he just says he's not that, you know, Dick is the best science fiction writer of his generation. He's one of the best American writers of that post-war period. But at the same time, you can also say he's also like one of the most interesting modern, or arguably postmodern, mystics that we have, because he was a writer. That meant that he produced a lot of text around these experiences, and then the way that the writing shaped the experience and the experience shaped the writing is, you know, from a religious studies point of view, which is, you know, what I'm working on now in my, you know, graduate work, is utterly fascinating. So it's fun to kind of see that balance shift. But, you know, I also want to hear what it was like to have actually read all of that stuff, because it's really important to emphasize that a lot of it is very tedious and challenging in all sorts of ways. So give us a little flavor of, like, the whole thing.
Yeah, well, first of all, I just wanted to say that when I knew that I was going to be doing this project, my first thought was I have to get as many other people involved as possible. It was partly because I knew I just wasn't going to be able to handle it by myself. And it's also because I'm really fascinated by the way other people read it and by what it means to them. And I found people who were very invested in the exegesis, very curious about what was in it. It was part of their own sort of spiritual or an intellectual journey to have come across it and to want to read it. And I wanted to learn from my co-readers how to read it, because I just, even from my initial encounters with the thing itself, which was three boxes of papers that were delivered to me 3 years ago and sat there in my apartment sort of breathing and looking like they might swallow the whole universe into themselves. I didn't know how to go about reading that, and so I immediately got Rich Doyle, who's been on your program, and from there found other people to just help me figure out how to dive in, and all coming from their own sort of crazy interest in the topic, Philip K. Dick and spiritual experience and whatever it was. So that was a crucial part of the project.
Do you feel like it got into your brain? Like, did going through his, like, kind of crazy brain, did you catch a little crazy from it?
Oh, totally. Yeah. And that's why I needed these other people out there, because what I did was, when I got the boxes, it's 91 folders of mostly handwritten journals. They were in no chronological order. Most of them are not dated.
Wow.
So I just started reading through them at random. I didn't even know what order they were in or whether it made any sense to put them in order, because I couldn't, you know, as soon as I dove in, I was just in the midst of this world that, you know, you immediately lose sight of any external kind of ground. You're just totally in the mind that is working on these problems.
Mm.
And so from within that, it's hard to make any sense of anything, and it's hard to make distinctions like this is important, this is not, this is crazy, this is not. You really have to give yourself over to being inside this brain. And so a lot of the process was was that struggle and finding a way to both get inside the brain and also get outside the brain in order to do what needed to be done to make a book.
It's such an unbelievable opportunity, though. Like, you think about, like, when people see a genius idea, read a genius book, for me, I'm like, what must this person's brain be like? You know, like, what are they thinking about every day that would lead them to this? You know, because I think most people just think about what they're going to eat next, you know, but you'll read, like, an amazing book, like a Philip K. Dick book, and then you're like, God, I wonder what it must be like to think in his head, and then you actually got the idea to, like, literally dive inside of his brain and get in there. So it is, like, that work is like a window to enable us to see inside what was actually happening in his head.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an incredible experience, and I hope that someday the whole exegesis will be, we have a dream that it will be online someday, and people will just be able to just sort of cut into the flow and see where it takes them. Because that's really the way to read it.
It's true. It really is. It really is this sort of, it was funny doing a project where the project itself had its own integrity, but sort of above it was this kind of grand vision, because like in Divine Invasion, Dick himself has this image of a three-dimensional color-coded holographic Bible, like this book of scripture, but because it was three-dimensional, you could turn it in every different direction, and each different direction a new message would come out, because you'd have this different sort of superimposition of all of these different messages, you know, the way that, like, you know, whatever, you know, Kabbalists have been squeezing that kind of information out of scripture for centuries, and he had sort of like a, you know, a technological update of that same idea that one body of text could produce a kind of infinite series of meanings and messages, and in a way that would be the ideal form for this thing, some kind of, you know, database where you were able to sort of burrow your way through and people could create their own hyperlinks and sort of draw paths between us. So it's such an interesting text, and it so much asks for everybody's sort of perspective. I mean, that's what makes him also different as a kind of mystical figure or a mystical writer, is that, you know, a lot of religious visions, they're even the people who are undergoing them, they might have questions and doubts and, you know, but nobody on the level that he did, where he was looking at it through as many possible perspectives as he could get. You know, neuroscientific, reductionism, you know, terrestrial control technologies, Russian implants and radio waves, and then all these different kinds of religious or cosmic scenarios that were really like a kind of, you know, global perspective, you know, sometimes Hinduism, sometimes Zen, sometimes Christianity, sometimes, and you know, real Christianity, like, you know, believe in Jesus, the end is coming, you know, get right with God because judgment's coming, and then, like, all sorts of Gnostic Christianity and Kabbalah and all this kind of stuff. So there's so many perspectives on it. In a way, that's what makes it, like this uniquely postmodern kind of mysticism, because there's all of these different perspectives. And in a way, that's what the project ended up kind of, you know, doing. Pam talked about bringing in other people like Rich Doyle and Jonathan Lethem, of course. And one of the things we wanted to do is, like, to get more voices in there. So we had a kind of, you know, modest number of annotators who brought their own spins. And it was really interesting because some of them were, you know, pretty dry, you know, dry, not kind of reductionist, but, you know, pretty physical. And so we're like, well, this guy had something happen to his brain, and it was very weird, and let's try to explain that from that kind of perspective. And then historians of religion were sort of weaving it into this sort of, you know, grand, like, metaphysical comparative universe. And we had novelists like Steve Erickson was a very interesting person to be involved with it, because he's, you know, so invested in the novel and Dick's novels, you know, and he'll just be the first one to say that his, you know, fiction is vastly more important and interesting ultimately than the exegesis. But nonetheless, because he had that perspective, he was able to pull things out of the book that people who are more interested in, who are naturally more interested in metaphysics and conspiracy theory, wouldn't necessarily notice. And so it really asks to have this kind of, you know, sort of festival of voices and perspectives. And I'm really excited to see what people do with it now, because, you know, at the very least, there are thousands of pretty hardcore fans who have otaku-like memories and recognize allusions and are just waiting to go through something like this and start to leave out, you know, different ideas and identify things that he refers to and, you know, trace the development of stuff. And, you know, I'm very excited about it. I'm on Twitter, and there's a character on there who I've known only through Twitter, and he's starting to read it, and I can see him starting to post, and, like, it's kind of blowing his mind, and he's, like, pulling these things out of it, and it's really a wonderful experience. So I'm just kind of curious, Pam, like, what, I mean, I know it's just come out, but what kind of feedback, or, you know, have you seen, you know, had interesting conversations or questions come your way that give you a sense of how this published version might live?
Well, not really, just because people haven't had time.
Yeah,
like we were about to go on in LA, and I had this ridiculous idea that I was going to be on the spot with these really tough questions from, you know, serious, obsessive Philip K. Dick fans, and I wouldn't be able to answer them. And then I realized, no, people are getting their hands on the book for the first time tonight. So I'm just going to have to wait for those. Although I'm still thinking, our other panel discussion is in Berkeley this week, and I'm still thinking, like, here in Berkeley, there's going to be some real hardcore questions.
Hey, when is that happening?
That is next Tuesday. Tuesday night.
Oh, excellent. In the day or the evening?
In the evening.
At what store?
Are you here? Will you be here? Oh,
yeah.
You should come. In fact, you should join us. You should be on the panel.
When is it? When and where?
It's at Moe's at 7:30.
Excellent.
And it's Jonathan and I and both daughters again.
Great. So that's cool. I'm very excited about that, but we're going to take a break right now, and we'll come right back. This is Eric Davis. You're listening to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network, and we're talking with Pam Jackson about the exegesis, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Daou. We're here with Eric Davis, and we're speaking with Pamela Jackson, contributing editor to the craziness that is Philip K. Dick's brain. And Pamela, I'm curious to ask you also if, I know we talked about the effect of going through the material on you, but I wanted to ask you if in your personal life, did you experience any kind of mystical experiences after having gone through his work?
No, I kept waiting for it. I think I'm really not susceptible to that kind of breakthrough, although I did think this would be the way to prepare the groundwork for it. So it could still be coming, but it was an interesting thing that Philip K. Dick said. He was constantly thinking about what did the revelations in his fiction have to do with this later experience that seemed in so many ways to come right out of his own fiction. And sometimes he would say, it was my decades of writing this fiction in which reality is exploded and dissolved and the masks are stripped away. It was this that trained me and prepared me for the experience.
Like he was making a prayer for it to happen to him through his writing.
Or he was engaging in a practice over 30 years of writing without even realizing it. There was a practice of sort of spiritual training that was going to eventually lead him to be able to catch a glimpse of the reality that he had been wondering about all these years. I thought that was really fascinating angle that he had on this experience, but it hasn't happened to me yet.
Well, it's funny because it actually, you can look at that in two different ways that involve us as readers in different ways as well. Like one, from one perspective, the exegesis, and you can say, well, clearly he was just, a sort of unusual guy, weird guy who wrote all these fictions that had reality breakdowns and entities communicating from different worlds in weird ways, and he was clearly kind of setting himself up in a way for these experiences. I mean, a lot of people, when you look at what happens to people with religious experience, if you're not going to believe a religious account, you often go, well, it's their, for some reason they've just mapped a certain way that possibilities might unfold, the symbols that are important, cultural narratives, and then just in the right state of mind, all of those things kind of become like a waking dream. It sort of emerges from your previous programming. And, he was certainly down with this approach to a certain degree, and it's, as you've said before, remarkable how much of what he's doing here is rereading his earlier texts, in a way finding anticipations or secret messages that fed into his new experience, even the kind of classic, story of what initiated the whole 2374, where the delivery woman comes to the door and she has a little Christian fish necklace, and he asks about the necklace, and then this triggers a whole scenario. There's a scene in totally spacing. How could I forget this? Manhai Castle, where Tagomi is in the park and he looks at this little piece of jewelry, and the light in the jewelry produces this kind of mystical experience. And so Dick, in a way, was like kind of setting himself up, and you could say, okay, that's what he was doing. But at the same time, you can see that in a totally different way, which is that writing itself is a way of engaging spirit and revelation, and that we, you know, whether you think about it as prayer or as practice, we engage the kind of weird virtuality of writing, the way that writing is sort of opens up its own new world, its own reframing of our experience, of our ordinary everyday experience, of our language, of how we think about things. And then, if you're reading this stuff, if you're reading the exegesis, if you're reading Phil Dick, if you're reading a lot of spiritual texts, you are part of that revelatory process. It just doesn't necessarily look like, you know, oh my God, one day I opened my eyes and, you know, I saw how everything was, you know, unified. Instead, it's like you are part of this, in a way, kind of collective weaving of all of these possibilities, which is part of the reason it's, I'm so excited to see what people do with this, because, you know, it's going to get woven into all sorts of other reading practices and spiritual ideas and things, because the text itself, and he talks about this, is alive in a way. And that's one of his big metaphors in a lot of his books. There are these weird oracular texts that issue messages, and he talks about them as being alive. In parts of the exegesis, he'll talk about that. And in a weird way, writing is alive. It's whether you think about it as memes or you think about it as just this kind of almost alien life that it you know, interbreeds with our brains. It's the Christian logos, the idea of a sort of God's sort of message or map, kind of configuring reality. And those two sides of things kind of, like, you know, go back and forth and echo, and they almost inevitably bring the reader into the game. It's almost like you can't help but play.
Mm-hmm.
So what's it like? You've been working on this, like, monster for so many years, and then where do you find yourself now? Are you still in recovery?
Yeah. Yeah, I've been in recovery. I couldn't bear to open the book at first when it arrived, and then, so I'm only now opening it up and falling in love with it again. I mean, and it's really, like, if I hadn't edited this book, I don't know how much of it I would have read, but because I got to edit it, I've read all of it, and I think it's all really incredible. And I'm really thrilled when I see it again, and there it is in print, and the little pictures, and it's just great.
When you say you don't think you would have read the whole thing, why is that? Do you think just because it's arduous, or
it's just exhausting? I mean, it's 900 pages, and I doubt I would have ever. I would have read at it, and I would have browsed it, but I don't know if I would have gotten all the way through it, even though I think it's really cool if you do read from the beginning and sort of take it as a story and just go on the whole journey. It's just, it's a big commitment.
So I've been, I asked some folks in Twitter land if they had any questions, and I've got one here, which is, Pam, what can Phil Dick's work say to us today about the world we live in the future? I know a big one, but I mean, you must be thinking about that too, because he talks about it so much.
Sorry, I have a crying 2-year-old suddenly in my ear.
what can Phil Dick's work say to us today about the world we live in the future?
Oh well, it can say so much. I mean, I think a lot of the time we go to Phil K. Dick's work to sort of see the dark side and the just sort of the, you know, the black iron prison. He talks a lot about the black iron prison in the exegesis that we live in, of forces beyond our control sort of dictating things. But in the exegesis, he manages to find sort of ecstatic possibilities in this world that I think are really essential to balance out that other side. And I think I hope that people will find that side, of that sort of bright and ecstatic side of Philip K. Dick, and really talk about what we can do with that in the future. What do you think?
No, that's a beautiful way of framing it. I mean, it's one of those funny things where precisely when you're slogging through parts of it, when you come across these passages, you know, and sometimes he's manic, you know, he's just like, ideas are just spilling out of a million a minute, and he's just like clearly like sort of blazing, you know, and that can be very like exciting and sort of, you know, almost like vibrating. But there are other moments where there's this kind of a real humanist kind of voice, a real sort of mature, almost poetic way of wrapping a set of words around the experience or the insight or the specific, you know, just the little details about his life or the poetic images that have come to him through dreams. And it, you know, for me, and I mean, I think a lot of people, like you say, are drawn to it because, you know, the world is a dark and scary and deeply weird place, and only getting weirder in a way that in some ways reading Phil Dick kind of prepares you for. I mean, I think that I know in my ability to try to juggle multiple realities and to see different perspectives and to, you know, be honest about the dark aspects of you know, modern life or even just, you know, the world in general, it was definitely, you know, helped by reading his stuff, even if sometimes it made me kind of crazy and freaked out. But when you see this other side of it, and when you really spend time with somebody wrestling in it, when you come to those moments of light, of insight, of faith, of, you know, a recommitment to love and to human beings and to the possibility of the poetic imagination, they really mean something. They're not some new age twaddle. I mean, it's like, you know, this guy, he sort of put himself, you know, on the line. And in a way, I think that that's going to be part of our world, whether, you know, people, you know, like some, you know, secular people or whatever, they want to just put away that, oh, we're beyond that now. We're just in a physical world. We have to deal with our physical problems. And, you know, I think there's also a real spiritual crisis. And in a way, he both, you know, represents what's, you know, what's wrong, the way we feel things are wrong. You know, it's like, yeah, it's hard, but at the same time, there are these glimmers. And it'll be really interesting to see what forms of religiosity develop, you know, as we plunge ever deeper into technology and the internet, as we learn more and more about how the brain works, how even states of ecstasy and, you know, religious experience have their own kind of neurological correlates, which doesn't mean it's just the brain. You know, that's always the mistake people made. And it also means that there are going to be all sorts of ways of, you know, tweaking or setting up that system. I mean, there's definitely a kind of post-human side to Phil Dick, too. You know, when he talks early on about what had caused this experience, for a while he's really obsessed with like vitamins, and he thinks that he, like, by supercharging himself with vitamins, he got like the two sides of his brain to speak to each other. And the details of that scenario are pretty ridiculous from, you know, our 21st century view, but the idea that there are ways to kind of train your brain, to set up your brain in those terms to, you know, kind of create a real, you know, a real shift, well, that's going to be, you know, deeply with us as we go forward. And the, you know, I think the new atheists are never going to be able to, you know, keep that one, under wraps, because it's just like this, you know, the secret is out.
Yeah, and the deck, I mean, this, the exegesis itself is a spiritual ordeal, and I think going through it with him, as I have, there was this constant grappling with sort of the darkness of the psyche and his own psyche and his own, the fact that he was being forced to grapple with that too. And there are many moments in the exegesis where it just all falls apart, and he just thinks, I'm an idiot. What am I doing? This is all crazy. I'm insane. You know, I've ruined my life by trying to figure out these questions. And then he picks up again and goes on, and before you know it, there's another epiphany. There's a moment of really just beautiful illumination, and to me, this is what the most moving thing about the exegesis is. You it's a path that he is on that is not easy, and yet there are these glimmers of light that are just so joyous and inspiring. And yet, as you read it, you have to constantly ask yourself, like, what was this chore? What was this ordeal that he set himself that he had to write and write and write and write and write for 8 years and never come to the answer?
Yeah.
Well, it's almost like that's the dilemma of the visionary, right? And those things that Eric was talking about, like that unerasable nature of the element of spirituality and confrontation with that in the future, is that the visionary has no choice, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It gets put in front of you and put into your brain through these experiences, and it's almost like the way I kind of see it with the ones that write it all down like this, it's like for them, that's how they're like trapped inside their brain with these visions. And so then they have to kind of like sort it out. You know, if they have any kind of thought process, then they're like, okay, well, I obviously have to deal with this. And that's just all they have. It's kind of like what Eric was saying. It's inescapable. You cannot avoid it. And so he was put in the position where he could not avoid it within his own brain.
Right.
Right. And that's mm-hmm. like the writing is his dealing with that.
I'm curious, when you talked about those moments of light and the really beautiful, is there any that like stick in your mind as being like, you know, particularly moving or interesting or have stayed with you?
Let's see. Well, you could probably think of one. I'm trying to remember. There's this great one in 1980 where he has the dialogue with God. That was one.
Yeah,
that's just really incredible. He had been working on his. It was a high point in his sort of system building part of his work on the exegesis. He was sort of constructing this model of the universe that was more and more sort of elaborate, and he thought he was closer and closer to the final answer. And then I don't know what happened, but there was this. He had a conversation with God in which he sort of despaired of the infinity of directions that his exegesis had gone. And I shouldn't give this away, actually, because it's just too great.
It's true. It is definitely, you know, worth reading. For me, that one section alone is really, you know, it just stands up there with the best spiritual writing or allegorical writing of you know, modern times. You know, I think of like Kafka's Before the Law, which is this short little allegory that you read it and it sets up this kind of metaphysical problem or confrontation, and then you can never get it out of your head. It's like that's part of the way you think about the world, and this you know, encounter, and even the character of the God who comes through was a real distinct personality. And there's not that much sort of real fictional density to the exegesis. He doesn't tell that many stories from his daily life. He doesn't describe images that often. There aren't that many characters. I mean, it's more like a kind of philosophical exercise where he's spinning out these scenarios, these kind of what-if scenarios. But when you meet the God in that one section, it's like the God himself has this really recognizable character, almost like one of the figures in his novel, but it's still different. You know, you really get close to that sweet and strange place between the literary imagination and something that is more, you know, religious or spiritual. I mean, for me, I think at least the one that's coming to mind right now is at the very end. It's one of the last excerpts in the book, where it's just a very spare, almost written, almost like a kind of haiku, a description of his experience, where he lists his own. He meditates on the fish and the light, and then he immediately remembers that character that I talked about in The Man in High Castle, Togomi, and his jewel, and how that light did something. And then he remembers Jacob Burma, who's this, you know, a German visionary from the 17th century, who reportedly, some people don't believe, you know, think this is true, but the general lore is that he was he had his enlightenment experience by looking at a pewter dish that had it in it and the light shining off this pewter dish. So it's like these three different moments, the moment in his life, the moment in one of his most beautiful characters' lives that's connected to visionary experience, and then this figure that, you know, he learned about through books and reading the encyclopedia, and but there was some kind of secret sharing across time. And then you read it, and I, you know, at the point where I got, where I was reading that after so much of this material, was like, you know, I kind of saw that, like, all of those things were shining a light into my eye, that, like, reading that and making those connections, that, you know, I was sort of part of that, that glimmer or that reflection that was behind all those three different events. And it's things like that, that if you read closely what he's doing and how he's setting things up, even if he wasn't necessarily conscious of all of it, the whole text itself starts to, like, vibrate and send off these sparks. And in that case, I definitely felt like I was, you know, I was getting one. And it's also like it's a really interesting introduction to philosophy. I mean, we spent a lot of time with the glossary because he mentioned so many names, so many philosophers, and even though he's mostly reading them from the encyclopedia or the Encyclopedia of Philosophy, he's got a very interesting handle on philosophy and the history of metaphysics, which, you know, for most people, they're only going to be so interested in it. But in a way, reading that stuff through him and through his eyes and seeing what he did with it really brings a lot of that stuff alive. And suddenly, if you can go through that process, then suddenly there's a whole world of thinkers and texts and mystical documents and philosophical documents that have a different character, partly because they've been bathed in the weird pink light of Valis. So, you know, it's again really interesting to see what people will do with it.
Do you have other... He's also shown the way to use these philosophers for your own seeking, which I think, you know, most people wouldn't think to turn to Spinoza to figure out what's going on, but he just has this wonderful sort of ability to find the light in anything, whatever he happens across in the encyclopedia or in a little pamphlet that someone gives him on the street. And I think that's just a wonderful example of, like, how to do your own seeking into whatever you're seeking.
There's a very DIY aspect to it. It's like DIY, you know, spiritual philosophy, and it's and then that too is a very affirming side of it. One of the annotators we had, Simon Critchley, he's a hotshot philosopher. I mean, he's kind of you know, very, very well known and in that kind of world. And, you know, if you really know your philosophy, you see that he's kind of blowing it a lot. Like, he's sort of, like, not quite getting it, or he's not putting it in the kind of normal context that you would if you took, like, a history of philosophy class. But Critchley loved it. He was like, but it's precisely because he can't, like, stick with it that he can take it in a fresh way, so he can actually really think. You know, like, a lot of times you read philosophy or whatever, you're like, well, I'm supposed to understand this, but you don't necessarily engage it, like, as, like, part of your problem right now. Like, this is talking to your problem right now. And he brings that urgency forward. And, you know, and it's true with poetry and literature too. There's tons of different kinds of writing in there. So so it's really a guess. So what kind of other than the panel next week, anything else coming up that you're going to do with the exegesis, you know, public events or stuff?
That's all that's planned right now. I hope there will be more, but this is sort of the official publicity that's sponsored by the publisher, and that's going to be the extent of that.
But stuff will happen. I know that one of our annotators is putting together a Philip K. Dick conference in San Francisco in September of 2012. So I have no doubt that will be a site of some interesting exegetical elaborations.
Yeah.
And then what's where do you go from here? What's next? There's no other Philip K. Oh no, no, no. Here's one of our, actually. Well, this is a better question. One of the of our tweeters. What about a sequel? Like, what's going to happen? Do we have any sense of what happens to the rest of this stuff at this point?
Well, and we don't know. We have the hope still of producing something that could appear on the web, but that is all going to depend on the estate and what happens, probably what happens with this book, how it's received, and, you know, we can't predict when that's going to happen, but I believe that it will happen.
So, I believe it, too. I'm going to keep that positive seed in the future possibility going. But we're out of time now. Pam, thanks so much for joining us here on Expanding Mind.
Sure, thank you.
Good luck next week. And if you're in Los Angeles this Sunday at the King, go check out How to Survive the Apocalypse, the crazy opera, rock opera that I was involved with, the Burning Man rock opera. So I just had to throw that little slug in there at the end, you know. But again, Pam, thanks a lot. Maja, have a good day.
Thanks, you too.
And
all right, thank you.
From Eric Davis, keep your minds open.